Well, thank you very much for the invitation to be with you this evening. My name is Tim Davey and I teach and research at Redcliffe College, which is traditionally a mission training college based in Gloucester, right by the cathedral. If you're ever around in Gloucester, drop us a line and you'd be very welcome to come and have a look around. And I'm a biblical scholar by background. My thing is the Old Testament. I love the Old Testament. So maybe another time I'll come back and tell you all about that. Very exciting. I did a whole PhD on the book of Job, but I'm not a miserable person, I hope. But that was 8 years of my life wallowing with Job. And I'm married to Hannah, who's a teacher. We have two little ones as well. So it's a real privilege to be here. Just by way of background, just to explain what I'm doing here, I thought I'd just say a little bit about Redcliffe in terms of the theme we have tonight. And the first thing is that we are growing in our involvement and activities around the theme of refugee ministry. And so, for example, one of the things we're starting to do is do training events for people who work with refugees. There's a thing called vicarious trauma, which I don't know if you've ever spent time with people who are going through a difficult time. And it's very easy to absorb that stress, that trauma. Well, imagine that when you're working with refugees and asylum seekers or others who are struggling day in, day out. How do you do that? How do you maintain that compassion and that energy without it impacting yourself in an unhealthy way? So one of the things we're doing is helping to train people involved in those kinds of ministries to help be resilient and help have a sustainable long-term ministry. Another thing we do is we have an MA in missiology with a particular interest in justice, advocacy and reconciliation. We have people working on refugee issues in their work. And also, I wanted to highlight two organisations that we work with. One is GARAS, which is the Gloucestershire Action for Refugees and Asylum Seekers. This is a service in Gloucester City that was actually started by the Anglican Diocese in Gloucester, as a service to help welcome refugees and asylum seekers. And they've been doing this stuff for 20 odd years. I've learned an awful lot from working with them. And another organisation is Home for Good, who work to promote the idea of the churches engaging with issues to do with looked after children in the care system. And they've also more recently done a lot of work on this issue of unaccompanied asylum-seeking children, advocating on their behalf and trying to encourage people to be involved. And the final thing that explains why I'm here is recently we were given some funding by the Diocese of Gloucester to develop a research project on helping local churches enhance their ability, their enthusiasm to care for the needs of unaccompanied asylum-seeking children. So we do some theological writing and reflection. We're going to be interviewing the children to find out what are their needs as they see them, rather than just what do we think of their needs are, and other stakeholders. And also developing a network of local churches who want to be involved to find ways of helping them realise the massive potential that is in every church. So that gives you a little bit of background to why I'm here. And it's a great privilege to be talking about this subject, but I'm very aware it's an emotive subject. It can be, it's quite a political subject. It's been in the news particularly recently, and people have different views on the exact policy that local or national government should apply. And so I hope that what I'll say this evening can just help inform us as a Christian community, or a gathering of Christian communities, to think about what's the situation. So the first part this evening, I'll briefly talk about what is it we are responding to when we talk about the European refugee crisis, when we talk about the needs of unaccompanied minors. What is the situation? And then secondly, I want to talk about how do we then think about the response we might make. And I'm going to take the Bible as my source for that. What are some of the ways the Bible might help us as Christian communities think about this difficult issue? And then having done that, I'll finish my the final section by asking, well, what could this response look like in the light of what we have seen? Okay. Now, so the first thing I want to look at is just a very, very brief overview of the refugee crisis. And it's fair to say this is not just a European thing. And some have even said it's not a crisis in the sense that this is not going to end anytime soon. In fact, because of political instability, because of environmental changes around the globe, actually mass people movements is here to stay. So if crisis evokes this idea that something will come up and then go down, well actually I think this could be a trend that continues. So that's another reason we really need to know how to respond to these trends. I'm going to put some images on the screen. These are charts and statistics. Don't worry if you can't see them, but it was just to sort of give an indication of certain things. So, firstly, what you'll see there, all you may be able to see is a little chart that peaks in the middle and then goes down again. That chart there is to do with the arrivals across the Mediterranean Sea over the last few years from January 2014. And I don't know at what point you became particularly aware of the issue of refugees, but chances are it was around about the middle of 2015 with the Calais jungle come in the news around the July, August time, and then the media was completely filled with images of boats crammed with people. And then early in September we had the desperately sad story, I don't know if you remember, the image of a little two-year-old boy, Alan Kurdi, who'd been washed up on the beach in Turkey, just heartbreaking picture. And that seemed to do something in the public mood, that it seemed to be a definitive moment. And that was just where the peak is in that chart. And things have slowed down a bit, but there are still many people still making that crossing. And again, you may not be able to see the details of this map, but this gives an indication of where people are coming from and where they're going to. And Italy, Greece, to a lesser extent Spain, are big destinations for people making that perilous journey. And this is an incredibly dangerous thing that people are doing. This chart here just says where are people coming from? And again, you may not be able to see it, but at the top, perhaps unsurprisingly, is Syria. We have countries like Afghanistan, Nigeria, Iraq, Eritrea, the top few. But you can see something of the concentration of people coming. What about unaccompanied minors? Because that's my particular interest this evening. I mentioned the organisation Home for Good, and I've been working with a chap called Mark Morley, who works with Home for Good, who's their project manager for unaccompanied minors. We're writing a paper together at the moment, and he's given me some really helpful information, so I'm not going to take the credit for all the things I'm going to tell you. How many unaccompanied minors, so under 18s, have arrived in Europe from these places? Well, nobody knows. We do know that in 2015, over 90,000 unaccompanied children claimed asylum in the continent of Europe. Now, it must be more than that, because they wouldn't all have claimed asylum. It's also the case that the further into Europe those children have gone, the more likely it is that there will be older boys, partly because they are just able to make that journey more. Possibly it's also because younger children and girls are sometimes exploited and aren't able to make that journey. We'll come on to that in a moment. About a year ago, Europol, a sort of European-wide police agency, estimated that 10,000 of these unaccompanied children had gone missing. So 90,000 children had registered, they'd registered to claim for asylum, and 10,000 had disappeared. Now, there may be completely innocent reasons for that. They just moved on without telling anybody. But there are serious concerns that a significant number of those may well have been trafficked. So you hear stories, for example, of the majority of people coming through from North Africa, from the Middle East, over the sea, are doing so through people smuggling rings, and there's an overlap that's been established between people smuggling rings and trafficking groups, criminal gangs. And so you hear stories, for example, of a child being told, when you get to the other side of the sea, you'll be put in a detention, you might be arrested, something like that. As soon as you get the chance, you need to escape and phone this number. And of course, that's what they expect, and then they land, they're taken there, they're put in a secure environment, and they differ greatly. And they escape, they phone a number, but this isn't the number of someone who's going to help them, this is the number of someone who's going to exploit them. Nobody knows how much that happens, but it certainly happens. But why are these children leaving? This is one of the questions that sometimes comes up in the media, isn't it? Why are people coming? Well, they're fleeing conflict. They're fleeing oppressive governments. This is certainly the case in Eritrea, young people. They're facing forced conscription, where they're forced to join the army for indefinite periods of time sometimes. They're fleeing from ISIS, they're fleeing from the Taliban, and their parents want them to leave, perhaps, make difficult decisions, because if they stay, they're going to be conscripted into the army. So there are all kinds of reasons. But then the question is, well, why Europe? Why not somewhere else? These are some of the things Mark was telling me. Well, firstly, Europe is close enough to the areas they're coming from that it's a more viable option than many others. It's possible to do it through the sea or on foot, on a lorry. Secondly, because of the instability in the region, borders are more porous. Borders are easier to negotiate. So one of the reasons that so many people come through Libya and then on to Italy is because it's much easier to get into Libya, because it's so politically unstable. And thirdly, they know people who have already made the journey successfully. So through smartphone technology, they're aware of people they know who've been able to get there, and so they know it's possible. So that might be another reason. And finally, they're aware of Europe to an extent through the media, and they perhaps see Europe as certainly a more stable place than where they are. So there are all kinds of reasons why they may be coming. And then finally, what is it that they are experiencing? And I don't want to dwell on this too much, but I just want to make the point. Well, unaccompanied asylum-seeking children are understood to be amongst the most vulnerable of all the vulnerable people coming into Europe. Last year, there was a report at the House of Lords where they were taking statements from different charitable organisations. And one piece of evidence said the following. Unaccompanied migrant children are, of course, particularly vulnerable to all these problems. They've listed some problems. Many of them face poverty, war, or persecution in their countries of origin. During their journey to or through the EU, they are particularly vulnerable to smugglers or traffickers, as well as to sexual abuse. According to one person who gave evidence, doctors in Save the Children's Italy programme, quotes, found that 50% of the children they are dealing with have a sexually transmitted infection. That is evidence of them being sexually exploited in transit. So, for example, people coming through Africa and landing up in Libya might have got that far, then they may have to pay several hundred or thousand dollars to a people smuggler to get on one of the boats and get across. They have to stay, they have to work, and there are only so many things they can do to earn that money. So as I say, that was just an overview, but I think it illustrates something of the scale and the depth of the crisis, of the suffering that is going on, and we can only get a glimpse of it. And I don't know about you, but sometimes I listen to those stories or those statistics and it feels very remote, and it feels very overwhelming. I think we're in quite a luxurious position in the UK. We can turn off the TV screens. A colleague of mine went to a conference of refugee ministries in Hungary, and she was listening to a pastor from, I think, a church in Hungary, where they said, we woke up one day and thousands of people were coming through our town. And they can ignore that, but we can. So how do we respond when we can just ignore? Well, let's think about what the Bible might have to say about the issue. I think just as a caveat, the Bible doesn't give us a specific political policy that should be implemented. But I think what the Bible does is it gives us a disposition, it gives us conviction, it gives us values that we may try to work out in our political advocacy in our society as well. And the first thing I want to say is, well, displacement and vulnerability are woven into the very DNA of the Bible's big story. From Genesis to Revelation, we see a story of people in relationship with God. Think of the Garden of Eden. What happens after the rebellion of humanity against God? Well, there's expulsion from the garden. It's a sense in which everything after that is some kind of attempt to come home. To come home to God. Not quite to Eden, there's a new city at the end of the book of Revelation. But throughout the Bible, we see these themes of displacement, of lostness, of not being at homeness, and vulnerability playing out. Think of characters like Abraham, like Moses, like David, who all had at least some periods of being exiled, of being displaced and vulnerable. In fact, we could say that being displaced and vulnerable is the norm. It's the normal experience of people in the Bible often. What I want to do is just highlight very briefly four passages from Scripture that might help us to think about these issues. I could have chosen many more, but we'll be here all night if we try and cover that. So we're going to think about the command of love from Deuteronomy 10, a song of complaint from Psalm 10, a story of hope from 2 Kings 5, and the flight of a family from Matthew chapter 2. So if you have a Bible with you, you can follow along. And this again is just to give you a flavour of some of the ways in which the Bible might help us to reflect on these issues. So firstly, a command of love. This is part of Moses' sermon to the people of Israel before they enter the land that God is going to give them. And Moses says, "For the Lord your God is God of gods and Lord of lords, the great God, mighty and awesome, who shows no partiality and accepts no bribes. He defends the cause of the fatherless and the widow, and loves the foreigner and sojourner residing among you, giving them food and clothing. And you are to love those who are foreigners, for you yourselves were foreigners in Egypt." So in this passage that's trying to shape what society in Israel is going to look like, and God is appealing to the people of Israel to love the other, to love the resident alien, the sojourner. And on two grounds, I think. Well, firstly, on the grounds of who God is. He loves the sojourner. Therefore, Israel should imitate the one whom they worship. They should value what he values. They should be interested in what he is interested in. But also, do you notice how he also bases the call to love the sojourner, the foreigner, the alien, on their own experience of alienation? You know what it's like, as if he's saying to Israel. They just come out of Egypt some years ago. They knew what it was like to be given a welcome initially as a nation, but they also knew what it was like to be the object of hostility. And it's as if God is saying, don't you dare treat others how you've been treated more recently. You know what it's like to be welcomed. You know what it's like to be shunned, to be oppressed. When you are the ones who are in control, when you are the ones who call the shots, don't you dare treat them like the Egyptians ended up treating you. So there's a call to gratitude, a call to experience and empathy, and a call to the character of God himself. The next passage is Psalm 10. And I don't want to steal the thunder of next week's speaker too much, who I believe is talking on trafficking, but I think Psalm 10 is a very important passage to think about issues of the exploitation of the weak. It's a really angry psalm. The psalmist looks across society in Israel and says, God, where are you? Why are the wicked getting away with terrible things? And so why, Lord, do you stand far off? Why do you hide yourself in times of trouble? In his arrogance, the wicked man hunts down the weak, who are caught in the schemes he devises. and he gives this great long description of how the wicked take advantage of the poor and the weak and the vulnerable without God seeming to stop them. And here's a description of the wicked's attitude. And I can't read this without thinking of some of the stories we've heard about unaccompanied children. He lies in wait near the villages, for from ambush he murders the innocent. His eyes watch in secret for his victims. Like a lion in cover, he lies in wait. He lies in wait to catch the helpless. He catches the helpless and drags them off in his net. How contemporary is that? And then the psalmist says, get up, God, he says. Arise, Lord, lift up your hand, O God. Do not forget the helpless. But you, God, see the trouble of the afflicted. The victims commit themselves to you, abandon themselves to you. You are the helper of the fatherless. Break the arm of the wicked man. The Lord is king forever and ever. You, Lord, hear the desire of the afflicted, defending the fatherless and the oppressed, so that the mere earthly mortals will never again strike terror. It's a tension between, God, I know you really care about this stuff, but I don't see you doing anything about it right this moment. Have you felt like that as you've watched the news? Have you wrestled with this? I do trust that God sees this, but I struggle because I don't see God intervening. And the psalmist is sort of occupying that wrestle. But there is hope. There is hope in the kingship of God. So complaint, wrestling can be a response as well. Third way we might want to think about what the Bible has to say is through the stories in Scripture. I've talked about some of the big characters, so Abraham, Moses, David. But I want to tell you about my missionary hero in the Old Testament. And this is an unnamed young girl buried away in 2 Kings 5. This is from 2 Kings 5. We hear about Naaman, who was a Syrian general. And at a time where the Syrians kept kind of raiding Israel and taking stuff back to Syria and taking people. And we read in 2 Kings 5:2, now bands of raiders from Aram, so Syria, had gone out and had taken captive a young girl from Israel, and she served Naaman's wife. So she was now serving the general who was responsible for her abduction, her being taken away from her homeland. Who knows what she'd experienced up until that point. But he suffered from a skin disease that he just could not cure. And this girl says to her mistress, if only my master, that is Naaman, would see the prophet Elisha, who is in Samaria, he would cure him of his leprosy. Naaman went to his master and told him what the girl from Israel had said. And as the story unfolds, they take the word of the little girl seriously, and the adults kind of mess things up, and then just about stop an international diplomatic incident. And Naaman goes to Elisha, Naaman is healed, has some kind of conversion experience to faith in Israel's God. And he then comes back to Syria. Now, the reason I bring that up is that story, I think, says something important about how God works. And have you noticed in the Bible how it's often the underdog God uses? It's often the younger sibling. It's often the weak and the vulnerable. Think about the climax of the biblical story as a whole, which is the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus. God accomplishes his purposes through the most unlikely of means. And here we have a story of an incredible event of international significance being affected by just the innocent wish of a trafficked girl, if I can use contemporary language. So I think I don't want to downplay the experience of that girl or of children caught up in the current refugee crisis, but I bring that story up just to say there's an example of God doing extraordinary things through unlikely and heart-rending situations. So maybe we can take some hope from that as we reflect as well. And the final story I want to just touch on is, I know I said I'm a big fan of the Old Testament, but I've got some New Testament for you as well. And this is the flight of a family, and this is from Matthew chapter 2, again buried away in Matthew's account of the infancy stories of Jesus. And we read, "Now when they had departed, behold, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream and said, 'Rise, take the child and his mother and flee to Egypt. Remain there until I tell you, for Herod is about to search for the child to destroy him.' And he rose and took the child and his mother by night and departed to Egypt and remained there until the death of Herod." Now, it almost feels like a too obvious thing to say, but it's such a small story in one of the Gospels that I think the significance of it often gets missed. I read this story and I think about my own kids, and I think Jesus' early life is a lot closer in circumstances to the children who are getting squeezed into those life rafts coming across the Mediterranean. Jesus' life is a lot closer to their experience than my own children's. And that for me is incredibly significant. We worship a God who chose to come to this world not as a supreme and powerful king, but as an incredibly vulnerable baby, the most unpromising of circumstances. The circumstances of his early years are more similar to a Syrian family fleeing their home than they would be from our own. And I think that again illustrates the fact that vulnerability and displacement are the norm. They are woven into the DNA of the biblical story. And therefore, as church, that's woven into our story, because our story emerges out of the biblical story. We worship a God who came not in riches, glory, comfort and majesty, but was born in the midst of scandal, of military and political oppression, under a death sentence. God met the pain of the world head on by entering into it as a helpless baby, dependent on two young parents who had to flee for their lives to another country. And following Jesus, I think, means being called into God's service and into a world that is marked by that vulnerability and brokenness. But I think it's hope as well, because out of those desperate circumstances came the transformative life and work and death and resurrection of Jesus. I think we simply cannot ignore the plight of those whose lives resonate so closely with our Lord Jesus. But having said all that, let's just move on to the so what question. Calling the title of this evening, what is our response to be if we understand more of what's going on within the situation in Europe, if we understand more of what the Bible might be saying to us. It might help us to reflect. What are we supposed to do? What can we do sitting here this evening? I've tried to capture it according to three calls. So the first is a call to reckon. And that is to say, I think what we've learned tonight is it is a call for us not to turn off the TV, metaphorically. It is to face up to the intense suffering that is going on in the world. And I feel it as much as anyone. It's overwhelming. We cannot imagine what it is like. It's easy to turn the other way, but I think these themes within Scripture do call us to engage. They call us to face up to the suffering in the story of the Bible, but also in our world today. But that's not just the suffering that's happening over there, but that is happening here as well. I think it's a call to refuse to ignore what is going on. But secondly, I think there's a call to speak. There's a call to tell the story of what is going on in Europe and elsewhere. And the Book of Proverbs talks about being a voice for the voiceless. Well, how can we be a voice for the voiceless? How can we make a noise? I think that might be in conversations we have with neighbours, with friends, with family who perhaps dismiss the plight of people. You hear in the media a portrayal of these people. Well, they're just coming here for a better life, and I'm sure they are, but look at where they're coming from. I think there's a call to correct unhelpful thinking on these issues. I think as well, what Psalm 10, for example, requires of us is a call to speak to God about it as well. It not only allows us to lament on behalf of the suffering, I think it requires us to. If you don't feel angry with God, maybe you should. Shouldn't this make us think, God, what is going on? Why are you letting this happen? I've spent a lot of time thinking about Job, and one of the big lessons I took from Job was a sign of vibrant, committed faith in God is a faith that says to God, I don't understand what is going on, and wrestles with God. Wrestling and complaining and lamenting before God is not the opposite of faith. I think it's the very stuff of faith when we're facing difficult issues. And God is big enough, and God, I think, gives us all these psalms of lament and books like Job to give us a language to do that. So maybe part of our response is to cry out to God on behalf of the suffering. But as well, there may be a call to speak to those in power. It may be a case of writing and speaking to a local MP, to local authority, to, in terms of national campaigns as well. Are there ways that we can add our voice to the many other voices who are advocating for unaccompanied minors or refugees more generally? And thirdly, to conclude as well, I think there is a call to create. I think it's easy to look around and think our societies are not well set up for welcoming the other. Well, it's all very well talking about what the Bible might say we should be doing for the vulnerable, for the needy, but I don't see that. I don't think that will be received well. There are other demands on on people's time and energy and money, I guess I'd say, well, we need to be part of creating a culture of hospitality. We need to model the kind of welcome we want more people to be giving. I'm really challenged by a former student of ours at Redcliffe who just lives this stuff, who opens her home, who welcomes, who engages with people. And you know, it's very easy to be very British and private, our home is our castle. But it's a real challenge, isn't it, to think, how can we be hospitable? Think about our church services. How hospitable are they? How hospitable is our church culture? If somebody new comes in, do we have welcome in our DNA? I don't know your churches at all, so you'll have to discuss that amongst yourselves. It's a challenge for me as well. But the final thing I want to say is that I think there's a call to create capacity as well. And just to give a concrete example of this, you may have seen in the news that Alf Dubs, a Lord in the House of Lords, have put across an amendment to try and get more young unaccompanied refugee children from who are already in Europe and a scheme to get them into the UK. And this was being debated, and one of the arguments against this, and I'm not going to get into the whether or not this was a valid argument or not at the moment, but one of the arguments was we just don't have the capacity. There are already desperate shortages in the care system. We just don't have the capacity to welcome more people. And I've got to say, I think we are complicit in this as church. We want to be welcoming, but have we made it too easy for those who make the decisions to say we can't do it? You know, I long to see churches in the UK be not just good news, but fantastic news for local authorities, for the national government. Imagine what it would be like in 10, 20 years when people look back. What if they could say, you know what, there was a massive shortage of foster carers. There was a massive shortage of welcoming communities that would support foster carers looking after unaccompanied minors. There was a massive shortage of hospitable societies that were caring for refugees, but the church stood up and they made a definitive difference in the life of the UK. And could we together as church create capacity? Are you a teacher who would be willing to give an hour every couple of weeks just to help a young asylum seeking child improve their English or their maths? Do you work in a company that could offer some work experience? Do you have plenty of life skills that you could just mentor these young people? There are so many practical things that we could do. But could we as churches approach the local authorities and say, we're here, we have capacity, we have skills, we have opportunities, we want to help you help others. Well, so there are three calls, and we can maybe unpack some of that in the question time. But I just want to finish with this quote. This is from Krish Kandai, who heads up Home for Good. And this is talking more broadly about the issue of looked after children, but I think it certainly applies in this case. And he said, what if we, the church, could be known as the people who truly care about the pain and problems of children who have no other family to turn to and who, it seems, nobody wants? What if the church was known as the most compassionate and hospitable family in the country? What if? let's leave it there. I think we're having a coffee break now, and then there'll be a chance for questions afterwards.
And just in the coffee break, we had a few sort of quick conversations as well. That was great, thank you. So let's just, take sort of 10 minutes or so to ask Tim directly some of these questions that have come up. One of the biggest writing catches my attention. How can we respond in a practical way? And then you did mention some of those things here already, to respond to the situation of refugees.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I'll answer that with reference to the project that we're doing through the diocese. So, a day a week of my time is spent on these kinds of questions and theological writing and things. One of the things we want to do is realise 1,000 hours of voluntary capacity. So, for example, I mean, when I was 15, I needed to do work experience and I was totally disorganised. And 2 days before I was supposed to start, I said to my parents, "Oh, I really ought to sort something out for Monday." But in our church, we have the leader of the district council. And one phone call to him, and Monday morning I turned up at the council, and he told the department head, "So Tim's going to be with you for 3 weeks doing a work experience. Job done." But I sometimes think of that, because there are things that, there are opportunities and ambitions we have for our own families, friends, children, that we don't think anything of. We just do them. And it strikes me when I think about children who are generally in the care system or unaccompanied minors who come into the care system. Who is it who's ambitious for that? Who is going to do more than is necessary? I mean, you know, local authorities are really squeezed, really stretched, as many public sector bodies are. Who's going to go the extra mile? Who's going to be ambitious for them? So, for example, one practical thing you can do is if you work in an organisation, in a company, sometimes you might get people who come and do work experience, they just follow someone around for a week just to get filled. One very practical thing is, could you approach the local authority and say, "Do you have anyone, a looked after child, unaccompanied child in the care system, who might appreciate working with me for a week doing my IT stuff?" Or it may be that you're a teacher who says, "Okay, well, I can't do 2 hours every week, but I can do an hour every couple of weeks or an hour a month just to meet with the young person and say, 'How are you doing?'" Now, I was talking to a friend who works in social services, and she said, and she's not a believer, and she said, you mustn't underestimate the importance of people just being interested, who aren't being paid to, you know, have that relationship with them. So I think that those are just two examples. I think as well, practically, think about when we gather together as church, what if a foster family were to come in the door? How well set up are we? If you have a Sunday school, how aware are you of the needs of children in the care system? You might have particular behavioural things. How phased would we be if they came in? There is training available for helping them. So there just be a few small examples.
And there was a question about how do we find out what's happening in this rural community, and hopefully that's an answer that bit as well, but also talking about, I guess, you said about asking the authority, but it's asking each other's churches as well, what's happening?
Yeah, so in Gloucester there's a meeting that happens every 3 months where any churches who are wanting to engage in refugee and asylum seeker issues gather together and sort of talk about what they're doing. It's been a really good way of connecting people, because I think there tend to be pockets of things going on. So for example, there was one church in Tewkesbury who the tenant for their maths was tenancy, I think, was coming to an end, and they said, right, we want the next occupiers to be a Syrian family. But we haven't got enough money to do it up. We need an architect to redesign something. And between that network of churches, I think they found everything they needed and raised enough money for that church then to offer that house. So there's some very practical ways. Partly it's about just knowing what skills are out there.
Yeah, I suspect there's a kind of thing happening around workshops too. You just keep asking them. Probably in this room, people know that. I guess on the other side of the stresses, you sort of mentioned the vicarious trauma. What resources can we tap in to overcome the vicarious trauma? And then another question, well, when does it all end? And how long can we keep on giving compassion? Because it doesn't seem to be endless, you know. So that sort of, you know, we have been giving, we're hearing the issues.
Yeah. So, well, firstly, I'll just say, come along on Monday to our training day. That will be a pilot event. It's the first one we're doing, and the plan is that, I think it's already fully booked, actually, or nearly. So we're planning to run more, and we'd also love to put them online as well. So certainly they should be available in that way. I think on the compassion thing, you know, every week you have a different person coming and talking about their passion and saying, you really need to care about this. And I think it's important to say you can't care about everything to the same with the same intensity. I don't think we're built to have a passionate burden for every need that is out there as individuals. I do think we're built as church to cover everything. So it may be that you get the need and that somebody needs to be passionate about this, but it may not be you, and that's fine. And there'll be something else that you'll be really passionate about that someone else doesn't have. So I think that's important to say. I think compassion fatigue is a real issue. I think a friend of mine said it's one thing when it's statistics and stories, but when you start meeting people for whom you are advocating, when you there's a name and a relationship there, then that question of compassion kind of goes out the window, because of course you want to do more for this person who you now know. In terms of long-term resilience and things, I think one of the things that we'll be covering is things on self-care. So how do we keep nourishing ourselves and our relationship with God, and how do we make wise decisions? The turnover rate in charities that work with refugees is just disastrous. Really high, because
the staff.
That's right, yeah, for the staff.
So the carers need
the carers. They're full of enthusiasm, can't get burnt out, and can't carry on. So one of the programs that we do at Red Cliff is called Member Care, which is a bit like personnel for mission and NGOs, and it's trying to build in that resilience. So it's not just fixing things when they go wrong, but building in a better rhythm of life, so that you're not just giving out all the time. But it is, and it's an issue in pastoral ministry and life, isn't it? as well.
Yeah. Okay, and then how can we avoid refugee children becoming flavor of love? So I think maybe you might have answered that in a bit, you know, in the media sort of side of things. And then, you know, the story comes again and again as the fatigue. Is there a fine line between welcoming families and then stopping them blending in? I'm not so sure where that's going, what the question is. Are we welcoming and the family's going to go back? Maybe that's what the question is.
Such a good question. So one of the issues in this kind of area is there is lots of enthusiasm, particularly when it's high profile. And so do you remember I said part of our research project is talking to the children themselves about what's your experience, what are your needs? Because there's no shortage of goodwill and enthusiasm, good intentions, but there is an issue of wisdom as well, and what's appropriate. And so, you know, it may be that when, if there are Syrian families who are resettled in this area, it wouldn't be a good thing if everybody knew their address and everybody came and. But there are probably wise ways of churches together finding a way of supporting them more without overwhelming. So I think it's holding that enthusiasm but channeling it in a wise way. I think sometimes when we want to help, it feels good to help. And sometimes it can be frustrating. So when in the middle of 2015, when it was really hitting the news, you know, people might phone up a refugee help centre and might even say, "I want a Syrian child, please." And that's great that there's enthusiasm there, but actually, there's no shortcuts in the fostering process. You know, it's just as rigorous as anyone else. So we need to temper our passion and enthusiasm with wisdom. I'm by no means an expert on all these things, but I've learned an awful lot from people like Gareth and Hope for Good. They really know their stuff, and they're, I think, doing very well at having an informed approach.
That's been really helpful. We'll round up there. So then you've got to dash back to catch train. So thank you again so much. And balancing the really challenges, but also not letting us not approach the, you know, go for the challenge as well. So thank you very much for this evening.
Mm-hmm.